Blog Talk Radio.
And now, a moment from the Movie Geeks United Archive.
Actually, we have some breaking news right off the top of the show. Chris, you are a new daddy.
Oh.
I am. Congratulations. A new daddy, it's true. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Brand new movie geek brought into this world.
Yeah, and you said the first movie that you showed her was Black Swan, which I think she's off to a great start.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah,
she's a little girl, so I made her watch Black Swan because that's the kind of stuff that we're going to be, you know, dealing with. So, yeah, Black Swan. And then actually we seriously did watch Inside Job together, so, you know.
Great. That's good. So does it... I mean, everyone talks about when they have a child that's life-changing. Do you feel it? I mean, was it a profound kind of feeling?
You know, you're overcome with, you know, as soon as your baby is born, you're overcome with this tremendous sense of responsibility. Everybody is, not everybody. Not some people are not overcome with that sense, and then that's where strippers come from, so...
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight, actress Karen Black talks all about those legendary 70s films that she was a part of with people like Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda and Jack Nicholson and Bob Rafelson. And also we'll welcome on the director, screenwriter, and co-star of a new film called For the Love of Money, which is currently open in New York and L.A. I am Jamie, and I'm bringing up Jerry. Hey, bud.
Hey, what's up? God, Karen Black, that's just fascinating right there. I mean, that's a wealth of history.
Isn't it really, though? Because let me tell you a little bit about the interview. This was something that an interview that Aaron conducted like a year and a half, 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and never aired. He just never got around to airing it. And I said, well, this is like history that I really love. So can I air?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah. So we still.
All right. Hey, thank you, Aaron.
We stole another one tonight, so how
okay.
are you, man?
I'm doing good. How are you? I'm outside. It's just really nice out today, and I just felt like being outside.
I like it when the co-hosts of the show kind of can be on location. I think that's a great thing.
I don't know if I call this on location exactly, but...
Okay, I know what we want to talk about. Let's play this, and then
am I interrupting? I thought you might be running low.
Pour yourself a glass, pal.
Thank you, but I'm afraid it will be wasted on me.
You think we wasted our time coming here, don't you?
Your question depends on me understanding what you hope to achieve by coming here.
What we hope to achieve was to meet our makers, to get answers. Why they even made us in the first place.
Why do you think your people made me?
We made you because we could.
Can you imagine how disappointing it would be for you to hear the same thing from your creator? May I ask you something?
Please do.
How far would you go to get what you came all this way for? Your answers. What would you be willing to do?
Anything and everything.
All right. Prometheus opened this weekend. Did really well. It was a must-see. I mean, just on Facebook alone, I've never seen so many people post going to Prometheus, standing in line for Prometheus.
Sure.
Can't wait for Prometheus.
Yeah.
I mean, there's such a buzz about this movie. And so now I'm excited that I'm finally able to talk to somebody else about it that's actually seen it too. Let me bring on
Dean.
And see if you, oh, you've seen it twice this weekend. Awesome.
I've seen it twice.
Dean, have you seen Prometheus?
I didn't go today. It was too rainy here, so I decided to wait.
Damn you, Dean.
Where are you, in Paris? I know it's raining in Paris, but I mean,
it is a beautiful rainy day, and I decided to stay in and watch I, Claudius instead of
That's a good deal. If I told you what I read today, I'm not going to tell you what I read today, but I read a screenplay today that I haven't read in 12 years, and I'll just leave it at that. I read the I, Claudius screenplay. I'd still be reading it.
So Jerry and I, let's talk about Prometheus a little bit.
Okay. Where do you want to begin? We have to be very careful what we talk about. I was surprised you played that scene because that's the key scene.
That's the scene that the studio made available. So.
Oh, okay. They made that available.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of like three official clips on YouTube.
Okay, that scene. I mean, you can be interpreted in a lot of different ways, but how do you want to talk about this? Because I do not want to spoil this for anybody.
Well, you were actually taken by it enough to go see it twice. So, did you see it a second time because there was something to the film that you wanted to understand more after seeing it the first time?
Well, there's that. I took my mom to see the Midnight Show, and I was afraid that I might have missed something in the first half hour, because I have to tell you something. I'm so exhausted by the end of the week that I do, you know how your body, you for a blink of a second, you're afraid you might miss something because you're dozing off. I mean, you know, I've been up for like, 15, 16 hours, and I've gone running or done something really just extraneous to my body, and so I like to miss something, but I also promised my brother I'd take him to see it. So I went Saturday. You know, it's the Inglourious Bastards thing, but not the three times, only two times here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for Django Unchained, it'll probably be seven times by the time we get to the show. Let me say this. The first 5 minutes alone, you could spend a whole show talking about.
Yeah.
The first 5 minutes. All right, let me let you in on a little secret here, and it's not a secret. If you go up to the elementary school library where I went to school, there are two books that I checked out a lot. One, the Bigfoot book. The other one is the Ancient Astronauts book. Okay? What I find fascinating about this movie is if we deal on just that thing of ancient astronauts, we've talked about two other movies on this show that deal with a similar theme, Mission to Mars, which actually does it actually very successfully.
Mm-hmm.
And then Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, which really just flushes it down the whole goddamn toilet.
Yeah.
But let's not mean it. That opening sequence is what those two films in some ways do deal with the same thing. Now it's your interpretation of that opening scene. And then this, Jamie, I don't know where you want me to go with this, because I really, if I go into what I want to go into with the scene, it does give away an important scene later on in the movie.
Well, I thought
that
it was
would be Idris Elba's explanation.
I thought it was very interesting that there's an interview with Ridley Scott that was released today where he goes into detail about
mm-hmm.
these decisions. I mean, it's deeply rooted in mythology.
Right.
There's a lot to explore there, I think, or at least it seems on the surface that there is. I personally didn't feel like they explored it well enough in the movie, but the angle involving Christianity and our that kind of thing. There was actually an idea that they had that they were going to explore
mm-hmm.
early on. That really got me kind of excited. It kind of what a profound concept. That
right.
they're going to make Jesus Christ an alien. Ridley Scott.
Well, that would have really been taking it to the extreme. But that's another thing I want to bring up, though. Is the one of the screenwriters obviously is a guy Damon. What is his last name? Lindoff or Lindoff?
He's the one that's been hired to do the rewrites for World War Z too. Yeah.
Well, that will be very interesting. But he is very. What's very interesting about him. He is, and especially you see it in the series finale, Lost, he is hung up on faith.
and I don't know if he understands. He doesn't know where to reconcile his issues with faith, which I find very interesting. But I think he does a better job of it here than he did throughout the whole series of Lost. It's not. I still think the series, the finale of Lost is very powerful, but I think he does it better in this movie, in this universe, than he did on that show.
Yeah.
He obviously using the Elizabeth Shaw character as his vessel for the movie. She is, you know, I got to hand it to her. She's very, you know, she stays a true believer the whole time.
Yes, she does, and I don't understand why. I mean, that's the part that I was missing most, because there's like two lines about faith, and there's a shot of her clutching her cross, and I felt that whole dichotomy was only paid lip service to, and I thought that there could be great drama and great kind of philosophical conversation about that.
They try to do that with her, I guess, boyfriend, husband, when he says there's really no need for that now. When she's, you know, he says, why do you even believe that? And it's interesting because, like I said, I've heard now, between my mom and my brother and me, there's so many different explanations for the film. But I actually think it is in Elba's. You know, when he says it, I think it's to Charlize Theron. He sums up the film beautifully. Can I say that, or do you want me to hold off till future episodes?
No, go. If somebody does want to hear it.
He says it is a military installation. They created something that they could not control. I mean, we see that. And when the space jockeys are running towards that wall, and there's that whole pile of their bodies and the two guys who are left behind for the night, they encounter that wall where you just have this wall of corpses. They created something they could not control. It also has echoes of Frankenstein. I mean, these guys created a Frankenstein monster. But the question is, why did they create this thing? And that's the big if. And that's where if there will be sequels, and I think there will be, given the box office overseas and here, this is in the opening sequence of the film. Let me ask you this, Jamie. Is that the ritual that they do on every world? Or is this like, is Earth like Australia, a penal colony, and this guy has been exiled?
I don't know. Ridley Scott even said that is not necessarily Earth at the opening.
Oh, okay. That changes everything then.
I think that, I'm no fan of mythology and all that kind of stuff, but the Prometheus legend, that he created humans or something in his image.
Well, he steals fire from the gods. He steals
he's punished. But he starts a new race of people, and that's kind of a loving sentiment. And then he's so pleased with that invention that he gives them fire, and that displeases the gods, so they torture him, and they have him they eat his liver every day, and then it grows back, and they eat it the next morning. That's his punishment for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that kind of the opening sequence shows possibly the origins of the human, because that's the ritual that they go through to form a new race. It kind of dissolves into the DNA strands and becomes its own being. And so the question is, we've taken advantage of that gift with wars, what have you. So that must be why the aliens want to kill us now.
Well, yeah, you can look at it like that. I mean, yeah, so they've created this thing that, all right, we have to rectify our mistake.
Right.
And that's what this whole series has been about then. And it's a very fascinating way to look at it. So this was an invention that gets out of hand. But then there's another interesting parallel storyline going on here, and that's the creation of David. David may be the most interesting thing in the film, because it's a parallel thing. Okay, the God, you know, all right, the engineers or whatever, but then man creates David. And before we go into David, you know,
I'm sure there's great significance in his name being David too. And by the way, let me just tell you that I meant to tell you last week about it, that as soon as Lawrence of Arabia came up, I said, "Oh, Jerry's gonna love this."
Yes, but you're right. I mean, my mom looked at me as though I was nuts because I was re-quoting every line in that scene.
Right, right.
I was going ape shit. But let me say this though, and this is while a lot of people point to obviously the Ian Holm character, even the Lance Henderson character, or even the Winona Ryder character for that matter, in the Resurrection, who does David most remind you of?
I don't know.
We were talking about him last week.
Who? David Bowie?
How?
Oh.
When we meet David.
That was so close.
Let's be very honest. A.O. Scott wants to say slightly treacherous in his review. I don't agree with that. I think David's gone mad. He's lonely. He's gone crazy. He's watching Lawrence. And that's a great thing to say because Lawrence goes nuts. And that when he, the blonde hair and everything, the way he parts his hair and everything, the way he's like touching it while watching the movie and quoting along with it. And I know in the viral videos, the Waylon goes into detail about Lawrence of Arabia. My God, David is just the most, the android is the most interesting character in the whole film.
It really is, and it's built as the scene stealer. But I mean, I just see him as being programmed to serve his master. And but the one character in the film that I did not like arc-wise
mm-hmm.
was Charlize Theron.
And I think that's going to be the bone of contention for a lot of people.
I think that third act kind of revelation, where she's with Guy Pearce, is like, okay,
mm-hmm.
all right, is you know I. She seemed kind of not dealt with very well, even though I really loved seeing her wearing those costumes. But
I mean, I think everyone did. But.
I mean, yeah, I know where we came from once I see that.
Anyway. Let me ask you a question though. Do you think that both the females in this movie are obviously precursors to Ripley in many ways? I mean, Charlize Theron, when she won't let him back, when they won't let them back on the ship, is just like in Ripley in the first film, because she won't let, John Hurt character remember. There's a very big thing conversation. But here, obviously, Charlize Theron is a little bit tougher. She's really, her great line is, "I'm here to make sure all of you do your jobs." And, yeah, that revelation, you either love it or hate it, I think.
Yeah, for me it was kind of a set it,
mm-hmm.
I've kind of immersed myself in Alien for the whole past week because I've been watching this Blu-ray set. And all the making of documentaries are actually on it.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find them at first, but these are like 2.5 hours each for all four films. And so I watched all of those, and then I went back and I rewatched the first two, and Prometheus is obviously a different monster than Alien, because Alien is it's very tightly structured,
mm-hmm.
and it's laid bare. I mean, it's like as tight a horror film as you can get. But I was
mm-hmm.
very much taken by how completely incredible Aliens is again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, God, what a muscular, exciting movie. I mean, just one of the best.
Yeah.
Action movies and best in terms of development of the Ripley character.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
I thought, why even go back to the well with Ripley for the third one? I think they betrayed a lot of what made that second one so great by going back to it.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. You're so right about that. I mean, you know, that that whole Aliens is so great. You know, that's one of the it's one of the great director's cuts. The director's cut.
Yeah.
It's amazing when Aliens came out that they decided to cut the key scene which reveals that Ripley had had a child back on Earth, and the child was, of course, long gone after she arrived
that's
back.
That's the greatest scene. You know what makes that scene particularly haunting is that they tell her that her child is dead. and she's looking at a photo of her child as an old woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That photo is actually Sigourney Weaver's mother. So, I mean, that's a really interesting thing at play there. Yeah, yeah.
But isn't that amazing that they cut that out? Why would you cut that out? I mean, if you wanted to cut out all the rest of the stuff, like, you know, the stuff with Carrie Henn, you know, the little girl, you know, with her parents on the planet,
yes,
and stuff like,
yes,
that. That stuff could go, probably. But why would you cut this most important piece of information, you know?
And what it establishes is, it gives depth to the entire relationship with her and the little girl, with Newt. I mean, it gives reference for it.
Exactly. Exactly. It's insane that they cut that. It's bizarre.
But it's also great because she's a reluctant hero. I mean, I think the moments in the movie where she's not entirely comfortable with the guns or what have you. I mean, she's not a soldier. It's not what she does. But she steps up to the plate. I mean, Cameron's female characters are usually, especially early on in his career, just incredible, incredibly well developed.
They are. They're all pretty tough. I mean, when you get right down to even Titanic or whatever, they're always pretty up there, you know. And then the Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and The Abyss as well.
Right.
They're all pretty. But he likes tough women. he enjoys.
Well, so does Ridley Scott, for that matter.
Yes.
I mean,
you're right. Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that's fascinating about this movie is that both female characters are also the third. There's a third one too. But we don't really get enough of her. But the two, I mean, Naomi Rapace and Charlie Serra, they're both very hard as nails characters, both very sworn to their beliefs, their core values. I mean,
yeah, and
Charlie
and with
Sarah,
Naomi Rapace, I thought it was successful, and I thought it transcended stereotype, and I didn't feel that way with Charlize's character.
Well,
but
I think we get with Charlize, though, in the beginning. You know, she gets herself out of the sleep chamber, and she's already doing push-ups when we first meet her, so we get a sense of what she's about.
Yeah.
She's very, you know, I need to do this, and this, and but yeah, that third, when you find out that thing, you're like, okay, yeah, all right, we got it.
Right. I mean, I like the film. I mean, it's a visual kind of wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with me that it didn't need to be in 3D?
Oh, I watched it again in 3D yesterday. I'm just like, where? You know, I think you should throw something at me, you know?
I am not. That's funny. But I am not going to go watch this movie in 3D because I, my big complaint with 3D is that it reduces the brightness of the image. So I'm more interested in watching this movie flat and bright, you know, than.
I would think if it's properly projected on 3D with the right lamp setting, it will look exactly the same as it does in 2D. I mean, that's my point. I mean, it looks like a 2D movie.
The only scene, there's only one scene I can think of that the 3D really works, and that's where the scene in the ship where you see the planets and everything, the holographic image, that's the only scene. That's a lot to ask people to pay that extra $4 or $5.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought they were probably, you know, kind of coerced into making a 3D version of it.
But I think that Ridley Scott, being the visualist that he is, he would be excited about working in 3D, especially in that kind of genre. I'm just surprised that he did not take as much advantage of it as he could have.
I think Scorsese did a better job with Hugo, much better job with Hugo.
Okay.
And then do you think the Madagascar 3D is much better? The 3D effects are better than that?
Probably.
Probably, okay.
I mean, I thought that Uber was going to bite my face off in that movie. So. I don't know. I've not seen Madagascar. But, you know, Madagascar came in first place with about $10 million more than Prometheus. It's a family movie, and it's a beloved
franchise. Yeah, does that really
franchise.
Surprise anybody? I mean, that makes sense. But let me ask you this thing. With the Alien movies, not the Alien versus Predator, I don't care about them. But isn't this a very big opening for for them, though? Prometheus is a very big opening. I mean,
I'd be very interested to see what it does from now on, because it is a brand new movie.
How much did it make? How much did it make?
$50 million. It is a brainy movie. So
yeah.
I'm curious to see what the drop-off might be like in the second weekend.
You think that's My Boy will overtake everything next weekend?
What is next weekend again?
No, That's My Boy and Rock of Ages.
That's My Boy.
That's My Boy. What the hell is that?
Adam Sandler.
It's the Adam Sandler, Andy Samberg movie. God.
When is
his star going to die? When is that star going to fade away?
I don't know. He, I'm going to see Rock of Ages tomorrow night. I'm actually really looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to that, too.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right, we have an hour's worth of interviews tonight. We're going to close the show with our last interview segment, but we need to play Karen Black now, and then we'll come back in between and do a couple of little things, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, Karen Black, Easy Rider, Five Easy Pieces, The King, of Drive, he said, Invaders from Mars. Did she work with Tarantino? I think she's in this new movie.
Did she? What would she work with then? Well, I don't think so. She's not in the new movie, is she? I don't think so.
Rob Zombie. I get Tarantino and Rob Zombie confused all the time.
At a time, that's understandable. I can understand.
Karen Black. One of my favorite Karen Black things? It's very obscure, but I love her in Reuben and Ed with Crispin Glover and Howard Hessman. And she plays Howard Hessman's sort of witchy wife that bedevils him throughout the entire movie, and she's got a couple of really funny scenes in that. But she's so great. She's been all over the place. I just recently watched a great movie with her that's very hard to find. I got it on VHS. I'm going and buying a whole bunch of VHSs these days because there's a lot of stuff that's out of print that's you know, you can still find on VHS. And I found Rafferty and the Gold Dust Twins with her and Mackenzie Phillips getting together on a road movie with Alan Arkin. And this is
wow.
Mackenzie Phillips and Howard Hessman. What the heck?
Do I need to take LSD before this? I mean, no, it's just a good little, it's a great little road movie, and it's got an incredible, supporting cast. It's got Alex Rocco, who you might remember as Mo Green and The Godfather.
Always Mo Green, yeah.
Yeah, he'll be Mo Green forever. And then it's also got Harry Dean Stanton in it. And it's just a few other interesting character actors in there. It's just a little road movie where Mackenzie Phillips and Karen Black are in the car. You know, they kind of kidnap Alan Arkin. Anyway, it's a great little movie.
She's also in Some Guy Who Kills People, which is from this year that we brought on the people, and I love that movie. I thought that movie was a lot of fun. And Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean.
And Trilogy of Terror. Don't forget Trilogy of Terror, the TV movie that she did where she's chased around by little voodoo dolls. It's the kind
That's
of thing.
Crazy,
that
movie scared the hell out of me as a kid.
It's a big cult offering. So.
And they made a sequel to that. Remember they made a sequel?
That wasn't
very good.
The Sex Tattoo.
Let's don't forget she was also in Nashville. She wrote some songs that she performed in Nashville too. So she's had a very rich career.
So with that build up, here she is, Karen Black, and then we'll come back on the other side in a little less than a half an hour, and we got a list, and we'll cover a couple of movie news topics. But here she is.
Do you remember what drew you to acting and performing?
I have to say, Aaron, I think that people are kind of born like that. I don't think that suddenly someone who would have worked in the bank most of their life decides at the age of 6 that they want to be an actor. You find kids are singing, you know, as their mothers are grocery shopping with them, and they're interested in being in the plays, and in grammar school, you know, they said, we need someone to play Christopher Columbus, and I'd raise my hand. They'd say, you're a girl. That's okay. I can do it. You know, I just always wanted to act, and I just wanted to take acting lessons. I don't remember any shift like anything else, and I just think that's common. And then I had an acting teacher, you know, and I would do community plays as a child, and very comfortable on stage. I'd cry on cue and never thought that there was anything that was difficult about it. And then when I got to be 14, 15, I would do summer stock. I would, you know, pick up all the half-eaten hot dog rolls and the old pop glasses and throw them away and clean the toilets. And then they'd give me one roll in the summer stock theater shows of the summer. So that's, I just don't remember wanting anything else. In fact, when I was in college, since I was so excellent at writing and at literature and English, I had teachers say, you should be a writer, and I have written. I've written about 5 movies that were made into movies, and I wrote a movie that went to Sundance, and I love writing very dearly, but nothing could keep me from going to New York to try to get on Broadway.
And you got on Broadway, I believe it was in the late 50s?
Late 50s, I was still at home in Illinois, watching television. 1965 was my first Broadway play.
Okay.
And I played a 15-year-old girl. Yeah, in New York. I did a Broadway show called The Playroom. And I played I guess you'd have to call her a mixed-up 15-year-old. And I was nominated for a Drama Circle Critics Award as Best Actress. So that's wonderful.
So in 66, you're in your Coppola's master thesis film. You're a big boy now.
I was in the play, The Playroom on Broadway, and a producer saw me, and he saw Peter Kastner as the leads in the play, and he invited us to meet this young student who was doing a movie as his thesis, and that was Francis Ford Coppola. So we met him, and he was lovely, a lovely guy, and we were in his first movie.
What do you remember of that experience? Because it came out in 1966, and so it predates Mike Nichols' The Graduate about 8 months or so. But both films kind of cover similar themes in a way. But in Geraldine Page was Oscar nominated for it, and has Rip Torn and said Peter Kastner and so forth. So, and it's a wonderful film. I saw it as a kid. My dad showed it to me, and I remember being very taken aback by it. And so I'm curious, at that time, what was it like on that set? And, you know, this was years and years before Coppola would do The Godfather and so forth.
When I met Francis Ford Coppola, I was shy. I didn't want to meet him, and we were in a hotel. I think I jumped into one of those baskets that has towels or things. Peter sort of rolled me to the door, Peter Kastner. And he was my boyfriend at the time. And Francis was very lovely, kind of, and intense in a very soft way. And he would move his hands around and play with his tie and so forth. And he didn't seem to know what his hands were doing. He was very loose-limbed. And I liked him a lot. And, you know, there was some time between the meeting of him and doing the movie. I think we did the movie sort of in the summer, and I met him in the winter. I would say December, November, something like that. That's my memory. Could be a little off. And in the meantime, you know, he took me out to dinner, and we were both quite nearsighted, and so we took up our glasses, and we pressed our heads together, and we looked at the chandelier on the wall, because, you know, when you're nearsighted, you can see all the colors of the rainbow in any prism. So we pushed our heads together and sort of looked at the chandelier and described colors. And I think that I might have been his girl, but he could see I was madly in love with Peter Kastner. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, he wore a T-shirt that said, don't overplay, because he thought people, you know, on Broadway would be prone to overplay on screen. I think he learned finally by the end of his shoot that, you know, it just doesn't work. You do things as big as you want to on screen. And you just you know, if you really, truly, sincerely mean every word you're saying from the bottom of your gut, it's going to be fine. I don't care how loud you are. It's still going to be real. And certainly, Gerald, nobody was making small for him at all. Certainly, Geraldine Page, she kind of make funny little tooting noises before the camera would roll to get herself in the mood. I learned that from her. When I made Invaders from Mars, I would scream before the camera would roll so that I could get frightened. Anyhow, she was so fun and so fabulous and so brilliant. And one of her lines is she pretty? Is she pretty? And she had this notion that she would just keep cutting her hair. You know, her hair would keep getting shorter and shorter. She just was amazing, amazing.
What was the machinations from You're a Big Boy Now to you getting into Easy Rider? And what was that production like?
I did this television show and that television show and this play. I did some plays. Just like your ordinary actor thing. The thing that was interesting maybe is that I, you know, at that age was supporting myself and trying to find ways to get on sets and buses. I couldn't drive. I didn't know, have a car. And I'd never driven in my lifetime. And I had my agent driving me around. And I would do these television movies. And I knew Henry Jaglom. I'd known him in New York, and it was because of Henry that I came to L.A., because he had an agent, Kevin Castleman, see me in the Broadway show and sign me at this very famous restaurant, the Something East, Upstairs East, the Something, the Sardis.
Mm.
And then I flew in, and I had an agent, and I would go up for these television things. He's a very pretty person, you know, young little thing who just come from the Broadway stage. So I got some television shows, and then, you know, we'd go out to eat, and I'd meet Jack Nicholson, and we started knowing each other a little bit. And then I just got a call, please come and audition for this movie. So Peter and Dennis and I went to kind of a patio. I don't remember quite where we were. Kind of an outdoor patio kind of thing, kind of Mexican looking. And
mm-hmm.
we improvised, and I thought that Dennis was extremely brilliant. Couldn't believe how good he was. And I said, he said, you're my goddess. You have to be in this movie. I said, okay. Kevin Castleman was out of town, so I typed up my own contract. Gave myself $300, which is what they told me I could have in this movie. Thought that was pretty good. And set out to go down to Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony Basil, who is one of my best friends all these years, still is.
Oh, wow.
Very good. My very best friends play the other whore, and well, you know, she's a choreographer, so she's
right,
used
right,
to
right. Choreographer, musician,
scheduling, you know, schedules and having people do this and that and keeping rhythm, and it's very organized. And I was used to Broadway. I mean, I had not only done that Broadway show, I'd been working in all Broadway shows for 3 years at that point. So we were shocked. I mean, we just couldn't believe the disorder. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Dennis would make up things as he went along, and maybe we wouldn't do anything. We'd sort of lock us in antique stores in the night, and we just got the giggles. Tony and I used to have this terrible case of the giggles all the time. We just wanted to go home. We were so unhappy. But I did observe that Dennis was extraordinarily intense. He had
mm-hmm.
very great intention. I have said this before, he had enough intention to walk right through a wall. He was going to get that part of life down. He was going to shoot that aspect of the culture of that time. He was going to do it. Nothing was going to stop him in this world. And he knew he was improvising. He knew he was making it up as he went along. But that's what he did. And he, with his magnificent spirit, imagination, intention. He started a whole new era of filmmaking because, you know, people were really doing what they were doing when they were doing it in that movie. They weren't acting. They weren't,
yeah.
You know, they were really doing it. And so it ended up being a great movie.
I'm curious, when you finally saw it put together and you saw what was being shown in the theaters, were you also shocked and startled that something was able to come out of all that chaos and that it became such a phenomenon?
Well, I know it makes a good story for me to suddenly see it, and I can understand your curiosity, but it didn't work that way. You know, as time went on, Henry Javelin was involved. He's a friend. He's still a friend of mine, good friend. Working on the sound and putting some of the mutterings that my character did in mm-hmm. the graveyard sequence. My character's mutterings were all gone. He put them back, which I thought was a great contribution. And then there were, you know, BBS. And I was already working for BBS. I did, I believe, I'm not sure about the timing of it, but I worked for Jack Nicholson when he directed
Drive, he said.
Yeah, so I was already sort of involved in all that. And so, no, it wasn't that shocked. It wasn't like I went home to Park Ridge, Illinois, and then went back. I was in L.A., Hollywood area. But I saw it with my brother, which is very dear to me that I saw it with my brother. And, of course, it's a very, very great movie, and I was very moved by it. And I was worried about my brother because he's a little too moved by it. Because, you know, in the end, I think, you know, when the camera moves suddenly up, 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 I suspect, from any of my, you know, Eastern religion training, I suspect that that can be what happens when somebody dies. You suddenly go up, you know, but you're looking down. And I think that it brings the audience into that sensibility, into that moment. And they kind of, I think it's one reason it's so shocking. I think without that ending, I'm not sure it would have been the hit it was. It was perfect. And cinematographer nearly fell out of the plane getting it, by the way.
Well, and so you said you were working at BBS, and so I'm curious, what was the intent and what was the atmosphere like for people who were in the BBS circle? And for our listeners, I guess I should clarify that BBS stood for the three people who were part of this production company, Bob Rafelson, Burke Snyder, and Steve Blommer. And this was supposed to be the intent was this was a artist friendly, filmmaker friendly production company where everyone was going to support each other's kind of film projects.
It was indeed, you can believe the hype. It was indeed artist friendly, filmmaker friendly. When we did Five Easy Pieces, we were on our own. I mean, Five Easy Pieces was shot absolutely in sequence. You know, we shot what we had to shoot in town. I mean, in Bakersfield, and then we went up from there, and we shot the story as we drove, just the way the story was written. So when we picked up the turtles, we picked them up, and when we went to the next place to eat breakfast, that's when we went to eat breakfast. It was really had a reality like that, and I don't remember anybody calling anybody and saying anything to anybody about anything. It was very artist-friendly and very free. I think that Jack Nicholson, when he did, I think, Steve Blauner's film, A Drive, he said, or it was VBS films, all of them. I think he didn't have enough organization. I think he could be a very great director, and I'm disappointed that I think some of these experiences sort of turned him off becoming one. He said to me, you know, I know a great script when I see one. I might as well be a director. Because when we were doing, I think it was Five Easy Pieces, you walk into Jack's motel room where we were traveling, you know, there were like, must have been 100 scripts there. And he'd have to, like, sort through or read through or get one or two pages and pick. You know, he always could. So, but when we did Drive, he said he had just too many things to do. But aside from that, which I thought was just poor planning, you know, for example, when we were doing Easy Rider, it was, you know, we were off in the middle of the woods. We were there together. I don't remember people worrying about money, particularly because we, what was there to spend money on? You know, film, that's all it was. But don't ask me about money. I'm not any good at it. I don't understand it. But, you know, it was incredibly. I mean, you know, go you do a studio film and people are watching you, watching what you're shooting and if you've gone over time and if you've gone over the budget and if you've gone over schedule and if you came in on time and if, you know, they like the rushes and they don't want to do this, they want to change that and that. None of that. Absolutely none of that. Where you're off on your own. Now, that is good things and bad things, but essentially, obviously, good things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because Rafelson took her script which was brilliant anyway, and just made it what it was. That was what you got. You got the real story. And Rafelson being very much on his own is how that would work best, and it did.
And Five Easy Pieces.
For Five Easy Pieces.
Yeah, and Five Easy Pieces is an interesting film in that it's the first showcase for Nicholson as a leading man. He's been in movies for over a decade, but he'd always been in co-starring roles or supporting roles like an Easy Rider and so forth. But Five Easy Pieces, it's a character study all about kind of a remarkable turn of the decade, late 60s into the early 70s, kind of a lost in the wilderness kind of character portraits that Nicholson was a master at doing, it turns out.
Yes, well, I think that I wouldn't agree with your line of logic.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't that he did all these roles that were smaller roles, and now he did the lead.
Right.
And the movies that he made, even including Easy Rider, I have to say, in terms of character and in terms of just a classic movie that'll always be alive, classic movie, they weren't as good as Five Easy Pieces. Five Easy Pieces is a very brilliant movie, and all these old, I've seen other these early darlings, sort of He's So Darling, and then these Jack Nicholson movies, and they're just not very good movies. And this was a very great movie by a very, very great writer and a great director. And so one could finally witness his full capability. I think before that one just hadn't had a chance to. You knew you loved him. You know, there's something about people, certain people, that you just love. And I don't think anybody can name it. I don't think anybody can explain it. You know, like Drew Barrymore. What is it about Drew Barrymore? I mean, we love her. We have to have more of her, you know? And Jack was like that. He just has that God-blessed smile, and, you know, you just have to have him in your house. You have to buy the movie. You have to go see it. Something about Jack, you know, he's just a big movie star. He just was born to be that.
And that kind of collaboration you all had, I mean, it carried over to the following film, which was Drive, He Said, which Jack directed. He didn't star in. It was his directorial debut. And Drive, He Said, is kind of remarkable in that it's never been available on tape or DVD of any kind. So this is kind of a landmark event where it's finally coming out. And so for those of us who have been lucky enough to see it, whether it's through a bootleg or a rare showing on TV, it is a remarkable kind of a lost gem of this period between of you and Bruce Dern and the other and kind of a the story of Drive, He Said, is kind of interesting in that it also kind of captures kind of that kind of a turbulent, chaotic period of life on college campus in late 60s, early 70s.
Yes, yes. Did you ever see Getting Straight?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
That was probably what's that word? It means sort of the center, the pith, the best, the most representative of that era in that time. Well, I think that there are some very interesting oddities about Drive, He Said. You know, I was in a bathtub. I think I was naked, and I was not into being naked. I mean, not really. I mean, you have to really love your body to it. And then I put on a robe and ran outside, and we were running around in the wet cold. And the man who played my husband was also a brilliant writer, is also a brilliant writer. And he was like, whoa, what? He's a conservative guy. He's a writer. What have you done? And running around and your robe was going to fall open. Everything's falling out. It was just it's a lot of crazy stuff. It was such an amazing, you know, difference doing that movie and doing Five Easy Pieces. There's such an incredible difference, just the sense of the place and the sense of the time, the sense of the light and color, and the sense of the character. We used to smoke in those days, Jack would say. Everybody's going to want to smoke when they see you smoking, Blackie. Better quit that.
I'm curious.
And Bill Tepper was in it, Bill Tepper, and... Well, tell me his name, the lead, the young boy's lead.
Yeah, Michael Margada.
Yeah, Michael Margada. Now, there was a gem of an actor. I think he's in Russia teaching acting now. I think he's a really the acting guru somewhere in Russia. I'm not kidding. I think this is the truth. Well, it was just a bunch of gorgeous guys. It was just incredible. Great experience. Very strange experience.
I'm curious.
Not strange. I shouldn't say very strange. Very, very what it was. Sort of epicenter Jack.
I am curious. You bring up the bathtub scene and so forth, and Drive, he said.
I didn't hear you. Bring up what?
The bathtub scene, you know, and
oh,
so
bathtub,
forth.
Oh, bathtub, huh?
And Drive, he said at that time, if you remember, was given an X rating. This was at the time for some of its sexual content, which I'm sure viewed now is obviously not as, you know, graphic and gratuitous as we see now, but it is very...
You're going to fail to get any good information if you expect an actor to have an overview. You know, actors don't have an overview. You do a movie, and then they want you to lie around and kiss someone. Then do another movie, they want you to sit in his lap and kiss, and you do.
Right.
And you don't think, oh, this is very interesting historically. All you know
right.
is, you know, you're kissing Bruce Dern, and whether you like to kiss him or not is really what you got your attention on, rather than what's going on in the film community in this particular
right.
decade.
What do you remember? Do you remember anything, I guess, anything that stands out during this BBS production period of your life? Because obviously it didn't last forever, but the legacy of these films has lasted. So I'm curious if, you know, when you think back at this kind of 5-6 year period of your life, what comes to the surface?
And I remember doing Five Easy Pieces, and there was a scene that wasn't in the movie that was shot, that we rehearsed in the bedroom with Rapelson, Jack and I, in a bed, just because we were sitting there and talking.
Right.
And what I had used was... for the character, for the scene, was something that I'd learned some years earlier when Peter Kasser and I were also sitting in another bed in New York City, and he had something to say to me that was a confession. And when he confessed it, he put it one hand over one half of his face. You know, and as an actor, what you do is you go around and you sort of make, you memorize things that you can use later. So I used that. I sat in the bed and I put one hand over one, because in this particular scene, I confess that I had gone to bed with somebody at the motel, in the another room in the motel, where he'd stashed me, Jack, when he went to see his family. He just stashed me away there, which I think was great, because I don't think the character should have done that, and I'm glad she didn't in the movie. But in the actual screenplay, she did. So I put one hand over one side of my face, and luckily the eye that wept was the one that was not covered. And I was just confessing to him and talking. And he so flattered me. He said, "You've got so many moves, Blackie." He so improved my confidence. He's an extremely generous spirit and a great, great spirit. He's a great person. And so Five Easy Pieces and working with Jack really made me a confident actor. It was a very beautiful beginning for me because of the confidence that he installed in me, and probably... part of that, the birth of that, is the confidence that BBS had in him.
Well, before I let you go, I got to ask one question of one of my all-time favorite movies, and since I have you on the phone, I got to ask if you could tell me any story or any anecdote of making Nashville.
Well, Nashville was heaven, and Five Easy Pieces was heaven, and each of them had a similar great... serene joy, but it's not exactly joy, because that's kind of bouncy. This is just heaven. Doing each of these movies was the most wonderful experience. Everyone was just beyond. Everyone was unbelievable. All these people were so incredible.
Mm-hmm.
In Nashville, you know, we were really a family of people, and he creates that, I think, with his cast. You know, somehow you're so safe. It's like a big party. Nashville was just a big party, not a place, in the best sense of that sensibility of enjoying one another's company. And I think it's, you know, he has certain predilections, Robert, or had. Of course, I always think people continue after they die and they come back and they make movies again. I kind of think that. Or they make music again or whatever. Anyway, you know, we didn't remember where the camera was. We didn't remember where the... we didn't remember we were being... You know, you just didn't remember that you were actually on film half the time. You just kept improvising.
Mm-hmm.
And you were in character and you kept improvising. And then what happened, you know, happened to your character. So it was an extraordinary experience.
And then you would work with him again.
I was standing backstage, you know, when you start talking, you don't even. I was standing backstage, flopping out my gown, you know, before I walked on stage for the Grand Ole Opry, and really, I didn't remember there was a camera watching me. I didn't know that was going to be a movie, you know, and I just happened to say to these little boys, you know, were, well, I'm going to be president, because that's how this character would think. Yeah, it was a very great time.
And you, had,
more, you know.
And you were lucky enough to work with him again on Come Back to the Five and Dine, Jimmy Dean, which was, you know, also a big film for Cher and her, you know, really, really taking off in acting.
Yes.
Which is unfortunately not available on DVD or tape, but hopefully one day it will be, because that also is a remarkable Robert Altman film and a totally different Altman film than Nashville.
Yes, it was strictly the play. It's exactly the play. So, of course, it wasn't improvised at all. But the thing about it, Nashville, to go back to that just for a second, I was going to say that he has these predilections. He likes the messiness of life, you know, the chaos and the idiosyncrasies of people and how it's unpredictable and you don't know what's going to happen. And you know, he loves to have movies sort of imitate that part of life. You know, it's funny, it's off, it's odd.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he gets. You know, when I saw MASH, I thought, oh my God, they're interrupting each other. But of course they're interrupting each other. People do interrupt each other. People always interrupt each other, except maybe you, Aaron. And so why shouldn't that be on film? And so, of course, he mic'd everybody so that each person had their own channel. So if you got interrupted, you could just print it all. I mean, you could just record it all. It would all be there. You wouldn't lose anything anybody said if somebody else started talking in the middle, because they had their own sound channel, everybody. He created that, the new kind of way of looking at making movies. And I just think he's the greatest. I love him. I saw his wife, Catherine, the weekend before last, because Sally Kellerman was singing, doing a show. And we had a lovely getting back together. She's just the most charming woman you've ever seen in your life. She's so gracious. I embrace her. And now, what were you going to talk about? Cher was just brilliant. She opened her mouth and was brilliant. She didn't have to do anything. Forget acting classes. She just was an incredible actor the minute she started, and a very lovable character on stage. It was a very hard character for me to play. I've suffered a lot, 6 months trying to get that character.
Mm-hmm.
It looks pretty easy, but it's a very, very, very difficult, very difficult characterization.
Okay, that is actress Karen Black, talking about some of the legendary films that populate her resume. And so thank you, Aaron, for letting us use that.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I'd love hearing about that period of filmmaking.
That is just utterly fascinating. I would never have heard that anywhere else. So why didn't he play that? Or, it's to our benefit, obviously, but
He's got several in his that he's recorded that he's never aired from years ago.
I don't know. That's just gold. I mean, that was just gold.
I know. I got something for you guys. Let's get to a couple of pieces of business, then we'll close off with our last interview segment.
Okay.
You guys want to take an Al Pacino quiz?
And Al Pacino.
Sure,
quit.
Why not? I'm going to fail it, but yeah, sure, why not?
Okay.
Now, I got every single one of these right. I just know it. Except I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure about one of them. And this is like a trivia thing to win tickets for his Alabama speaking engagement.
Oh, okay.
I don't live in Alabama, but if I win this contest, I'm going to give Jason O'Brien the ticket so he can go see Pacino talk.
No, I think you should go crash Jason O'Brien's house. And
can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Just making sure that I was back on. Okay.
You actually sound good tonight.
Oh, good. All right.
Number one, here's the first of 15 questions. You ready?
All right.
What actor used Pacino as the centerpiece for his graduate school thesis on method acting?
What was the question again? What was?
There was an actor that was doing a graduate school thesis on method acting, and he interviewed Pacino as his subject. What actor was it?
Well, I have no idea there.
Any
Ben
guess,
Foster.
Jerry? Ben Foster? Is that what you said?
I honestly don't know.
you get an A for originality. That's good.
Okay, thank you.
It's Alec Baldwin.
Really? Okay,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And this doesn't provide the answers. I'm just telling you it's Alec Baldwin.
Okay.
Number two, what do Pacino, Barry Fitzgerald, and Jamie Foxx have in common?
Oh, I know that one. They were actors that were both nominated for Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor in the same year.
Oh, then I got that wrong. Well, actually, I didn't get it
wrong.
That's
good. Good for you, Gene. That's good. Well, I'm curious, what was Barry Fitzgerald nominated for?
Barry Fitzgerald, this is the only time in Academy Award history that this ever happened, but he was actually nominated for Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor for the same role in Going My Way. And he won Best Supporting Actor.
Here's what's going to be troubling for them, because I answered the question and I didn't give that answer, which I'm sure that was the answer they were looking for, but I still gave an answer that was correct. They've each won one Oscar. I mean,
that's true, but that's not what they're looking for.
No, but it's still correct.
It's true, and they both each won Oscars in the year that they were nominated for both awards.
So they can't disqualify me. They can't disqualify me for saying that's not the correct answer we're looking for. I mean, it's either correct or it's not.
Yeah, I would. You're technically right, but they could disqualify you for anything.
That's true. And this is Alabama. Number three, this is the one I wasn't certain of. What do Pacino and his Godfather co-star, Talia Shire, have in common?
What do they have in common? Their families are both from the same part of Italy.
That's what I said. I said they're both
Sicily
Sicilian
or whatever.
I said that they're both Sicilian. So hopefully that's right. That's the one I don't know the answer.
I hope so too.
Number four. Pacino has never. This is a personal question. Pacino has never married, but named two of the women he has been linked with romantically.
Oh, Diane Keaton and Beverly D'Angelo.
Yeah.
Very good.
That I know. Okay, of all things, that I know.
And you also have Jill Clayburgh. You have Kathleen Quinlan.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right, Kathleen Quinlan. I didn't know about you. When was Jill Clayburgh?
70s.
Okay.
And then Kathleen Quinlan was around Scarface time.
Well, I feel sorry for her.
Why I know this shit, I don't have no idea.
No, but he must have put up with a lot of BS from when he was in that character.
Yeah, that couldn't have been the most comfortable relationship at that time.
I know.
Number five, what role in the Star Wars saga did Pacino turn down?
Han Solo?
Right. Number six, what is considered Pacino's film debut?
Panic in Needle Park?
No, it's something else. It's something earlier. It's oh, it's from the 60s. It is, oh god. And he's in, no, it's Clute. It's Clute. Is it, it's Clute? No, it's not Clute. Jeez, he's in Clute.
Well, according to Premiere, back in the day, it was Panic in Needle Park.
Really? Okay.
I don't dispute you, Dean.
I can't remember what it is.
That's what I'm going. I'm going by that filmography from long ago.
You want me to tell you what it is?
Yes,
yeah.
Please.
It's Me, Natalie, Patty Duke movie.
Me, Natalie.
Oh,
that's it.
Wow.
That's what I was thinking of. That's, he appears in a party scene in that. That's that movie with Patty Duke. That's it. That's what I was trying to think of.
Right. Number 7, Pacino directed Looking for Richard. What is the film about?
It's about the production
of making
Richard III.
I mean, about his
Very good. Where did Pacino get the bulk of his method acting training?
The Actors Studio?
Yeah. Pacino won a Tony Award for his Broadway debut in what play?
Is it The Idiot Takes the Bronx or something
that's
like
good,
that?
That's a good guess. I think that was his second.
I can't
American Buffalo?
Oh,
well.
No, that's way later.
By the way, the Tony Awards.
Yeah,
Tony
I thought it would be The Indian Ones the Bronx, too, but okay.
The Tony Awards are tonight, actually. The Indian wants the no. Does the tiger wear a necktie? Was his
a necktie? Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Last year, Pacino earned a Tony nomination for his portrayal of what Shakespearean character?
It was the lead in Merchant of Venice. It's the
Shylock.
Yes.
Very good. Name 2 real-life people that Pacino has portrayed on stage, film, or TV.
Jack Kevorkian and the person in The Insider. I don't know the guy in The Insider's name.
It's Lowell Bergman.
Right. I put Lowell Bergman and Frank Serpico. That's better.
I mean, forget Frank Serpico.
He's played a lot of real lifers, if you think about
it. Yeah, no, I mean...
Pacino was Oscar-nominated for Best Actor for And Justice for All, but lost to Dustin Hoffman in Kramer versus Kramer. Why is this interesting?
That's a weird question. I don't understand that question, really, but why is this interesting? Because people got them confused a lot?
Well, that's true. That is true.
That is true at the time, definitely. I mean,
But it's interesting because Al Pacino turned down Kramer versus Kramer.
Wow.
What was Pacino's childhood nickname?
Bean.
Booby.
Booby? Is that what you said?
Booby.
Wow.
Whoa,
I actually
know this one, too. His childhood nickname was Sonny.
Oh,
interesting. Wow.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
That's fascinating. Wow. Oh, my God.
And I remember being in line. Like, this was the night after I met him backstage at the play, and then I just stood with the other fans back in the backstage area to greet him, like, the next night, because I wanted to get as many glimpses of him as I possibly could.
Right.
One of the female fans said, "Do people still call you Sonny?" And he was like, "No, I haven't been called that in a long time." So, number 14, Pacino is starring as what legendary music figure? In an HBO movie.
Oh, Phil Spector.
Phil Spector, of course.
And last question. What has Pacino called the most popular movie he has ever made?
Scarface.
I would say Scarface, too.
That's what I say as well. I think that's right.
Yeah, I mean, he has said that.
Godfather, I mean, it's either Scarface or The Godfather. It's one of the two.
I think the Scarface, though, is more popular than The Godfather in that sense.
Terms of people stopping him on the street, kind of popular, I'm sure it's Scarface. People quote that.
You're probably right.
That's like instantly quotable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so thank you guys for playing the Al Pacino trivia game.
I'm glad that we could do it for you.
I hope you win, and I hope you get to crash at Jason O'Brien's house.
Yeah, I think that'll be good. You guys know about this 50 Shades of Grey thing?
Yes, I do know. I've never read any of them, regardless of what people say about me, but I've never read them, so...
We're all dudes, so, you know, they are all over the place. Like, even in my office, the women in my office are reading it, and then I walk out to a parking lot, and I see it in someone's car, and, I mean, it's like, so the big question is the movie version, what's going to happen there, and I guess Angelina Jolie is the front runner to direct it, and this is a highly erotic book, you know, so...
Wow, okay. She's going to direct it. Okay.
Wes Anderson revealed his list of top 10 New York films, his top 10 favorite New York movies.
Okay. I want to hear this.
Wes Anderson was born in Texas. Here are his top 10 New York movies. Number 10 is New Jack City.
Yes.
Oh, my God. No wonder I love him so much. Okay, go on.
He says about it, I just like the title. I never actually saw them. He said, this is great. He says, I never actually saw the movie, but the title has always stuck with me. It's a great way to refer to New York City. What does it even mean? That's great. Number 9, Hannah and Her Sisters.
Definitely. Any Woody Allen movie, but definitely that one.
That's got some real love of New York. That great scene where Sam Worthington takes Diane Weist and what's her name, Carrie Fisher, off to take a look at all the different buildings and critique them and everything.
You're absolutely right, Dean. You're absolutely right. But before he went. Continental on us. No, he was he really didn't know how to make a New York movie like no one else. I mean, he really showed us, like, even in New York Stories.
Yeah.
He shows us, like, New York, like, wow. He makes New York I want to live there kind of movies, you know?
He makes a romantic New York, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Manhattan convinced me that I had to live in New York.
Great. You're absolutely right. Yeah, definitely.
Number 8, Next Stop, Greenwich Village.
That's a neat little movie, a Paul Mazursky movie from the mid-70s with Christopher Walken in a major lead, a major supporting role, and Shelley Winters, and... That's an interesting movie.
Rosemary's Baby, number 7.
It makes a great use
that apartment building, yeah.
Yeah, the Dakota. Isn't that where Lennon was assassinated?
Yeah.
Number
6.
And
I guess Yoko still lives there, so.
Yeah. Sweet Smell of Success, number 6.
That's the Michael J. Fox movie?
No,
I like that movie.
The Sweet Smell of Success.
I know. I'm joking.
I knew you were joking.
I love that. I have the criterion of that movie. I love that movie. That's such a good movie. I mean,
yeah.
It is.
But judging from New Jack City, though, I mean, I was just like, okay.
That's true. Yeah, this is open to anything.
Sweet Smell of Success really captures the darkness of New York City, you know, very well.
You're right.
The visual and sort of emotional darkness, yeah.
He puts New York Stories as number 5.
Really?
The Scorsese.
The Scorsese is my favorite of the three.
The Scorsese one is great, but and the Coppola one is terrible, and you know, of course, the Woody Allen one is fun, but it's not great, you know. So
it is. Scorsese is the masterpiece of the three. I mean,
it was a really interesting concept, though, wasn't it?
I agree with you.
It was a great idea for an anthology thing, and it's mostly successful, you know. But you do have to, boy, sitting through that Coppola one in the middle of it, though. I mean, that's why they put it in the middle, too, you know. It's just, boy, that's a slog.
Number four is Moonstruck.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's a good movie. Moonstruck. I like that movie, but wow, okay. He's all over the place on this.
Number three is The Apartment.
Yeah, you gotta put. Yeah, that's gotta be in there.
I mean, I'm not the hugest fan of The Apartment, but I guess I can. I guess so. I can think of the other movies I would put on other than The Apartment.
Right? Number two is a movie called Girlfriends from 1978.
That is a really unusual choice.
Yeah, that's a John Belushi movie, right?
No, that's Old Boyfriends that you're thinking
old
of.
Old Boyfriends. I don't know. Girlfriends, and I don't know. Well, who is in Girlfriends?
Is that Margot Kidder? I forget who's in it.
This is what he says about it. This is one I read about in some old interview with Stanley Kubrick. It's a very good movie about a girl who's dealing with being on her own and figuring out how to become a photographer. It's like a 16mm independent film directed by a woman named Claudia Weill. Christopher Guest has a small part in it, too.
Wow. Okay, I don't know this film at all. Wow.
I can't even remember if I've seen that, because it's hard to find now. So
his number one is a movie called The Plot Against Harry from 1980.
That's a great movie. That's an awesome movie.
Yeah, it is. It's really good. That movie feels like the lost Scorsese comedy or something. You know, it's weird. You know, it is funny, and it does have that sort of wonderful 60s gritty kind of feel.
When was that released, Dean? That was in the mid 80s, wasn't it? It was released for the first time.
It was like 89.
I've watched that. Thanks to Netflix, I was able to watch that, and I couldn't stop laughing during it.
Yeah, that's a hilarious movie that doesn't get a lot of play.
You know what movie I really like is that Matthew Broderick, Alec Baldwin movie. I forget the big shot or the big...
That's a very good movie.
The Last Shot.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good, fun movie.
Really good movie, Jamie.
That movie always made me laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, I want to bring to everyone's attention, one of our most loyal listeners actually wrote a guest. He's been a guest on the show, too. Wrote a review of Movie Geeks United on his blog. You'll be stunned by how much he pays attention to the show. I mean, the detail in which he goes through some past shows and conversations that he really dug. Joseph Eisenberg, and I've linked his review of our show on our Twitter and Facebook pages, so go check it out. And also our YouTube channel, we've uploaded lots of great stuff, like over 300 videos so far.
We have the Frank Langella thing, what's the guy's name, Martin Landau?
Yeah.
I can't believe you actually made a special, but okay, fair enough.
No, all those oddball conversations that we've had, I'm combing through those right now, and the great Martin Landau debate that Chris and I had, that's on there now, and the worst movies from our best actors, that conversation's there now. Of course, all the interviews are there too. So I want to get to a list and get your opinion on it, since this is very relevant now at this time, and then we'll close out with our last interview. This is a list compiled by IGN. It's their top comic book movies. I want to go through the top 10. They list 25, but here's the top 10. Number 10 is A History of Violence.
Yeah, it deserves to be somewhere if they're going to put it on as a graphic novel. Yeah, it deserves to be on, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, so much so that you absolutely do not consider that based on a graphic novel.
No, you don't, but I'm happy to see it on there, though. So.
And the person who adapted it, I can't remember the Roger's name, actually Oscar nomination for that. So it's one of the first mm-hmm. movies to actually get Academy recognition for that was taken from a graphic novel. So.
Number 9 is Iron Man.
Yeah. That's just so fun. I mean, that's a movie that I, as much as I couldn't, I don't really like a lot of superhero things, but that's a movie that's kind of impossible to hate.
Number 8 is Spider-Man.
Okay.
There's going to be lots of man in this.
Man heavy.
I like Spider-Man 2 better than Spider-Man.
Oh, I think Spider-Man 2 is definitely a far superior film.
Yeah, it is. Because it's funnier and you get a little bit more, I think their villain's better and you get a little bit more, sense of who Peter Parker really is. I like the second one.
No, it's a better movie. I agree with you, Dean. It's a far superior movie.
Number 7 is X2, X-Men United.
Mm-hmm. I have no problem with that.
The best in the series?
I don't know. It's between that or First Class. I don't know, though.
I haven't seen everything in the series, but I did like that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Which one is First Class?
That's with Matthew Vaughn. That's the reboot, I guess.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. I'm not a huge comic book guy, but I've seen all of those, so yeah. Number 6, Road to Perdition.
Oh, I'm glad that's on it. That's a very good film. Wow, this guy's really taking some bold risk here. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I like that movie. It's a little cliched at times, but I like that movie mostly for its photography. I think the photography
is incredible. Yeah. Number 5 is X-Men First Class. There you go.
Okay.
Number 4 is Batman Begins.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. That movie is head and shoulders above The Dark Knight, although I'm sure Dark Knight is number 1 on this list. But I still like that one a lot.
Number 3 is really what started it all, at least for our modern age, I think. But Superman the movie, Richard Donner's
mm-hmm.
Superman.
I agree with that. I think I agree. I still love that movie. I have tremendous affection for it.
Yeah, and you think of Peter Jackson and what he went through with shooting the 3 Lord of the Rings back-to-back. Richard Donner shot Superman 1 and 2 simultaneously. Shot them simultaneously.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. And Superman 2 is I love Superman 2, actually, very much.
Right.
Yeah. It's a little bit more comic booky than the other one is. The first one almost raises the story up to like being like literature almost,
right.
As opposed to just a comic book thing. But the second one has more of a comic booky flair, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That might be the contribution that maybe Richard Lester put into it, because, you know, Richard mm-hmm. Lester gets the directing credit on the second one as opposed to Richard Donner.
Yeah. Number 2 is Spider-Man 2.
Oh, okay,
oh.
Cool.
Well, there you go.
And number 1 is The Dark Knight. There you go.
You know, all that list, you know, I would include 2 non- superhero comic books, and that would be Ghost World by Terry Wagoff,
mm-hmm.
Which is based on the Daniel Clowes comic, and also American Splendor.
I would include both those. There's another one I would include on there, The Crow.
Right.
Mm. And here's one other movie that I would say is not necessarily a comic book movie, because it's not based on a comic, but it gets the feeling of comic books right so great, and it's also about comic books, and that's Unbreakable.
Chippy, you're absolutely right.
I
think that's his best film, personally, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I know Ghost World is number 19 and American Splendor is number 17 on this list.
Oh, good.
So they do pay service to them.
Okay, no, good.
By the way, before you go to the next interview, can I just talk about this for just like a couple of minutes? I'm sitting watching the 35th anniversary edition of I, Claudius, which I spent a lot of the day yesterday and a lot of the day today watching. So I watched all 13 episodes. I, Claudius came out on PBS. It was made for BBC in 1976. It came out in America in 77. So this is the 35th anniversary edition of it. And I think it might be the first time that you're able to see I, Claudius on DVD. And I would seriously recommend everybody. I mean, it's a television product, but it is so great.
It's wonderful. It's awesome.
It is so meaty and wonderful and funny and strange, and it's superb. It's got John Hurt. It's got a lot of sci-fi people who were in sci-fi later. So it's got John Hurt, who was in Alien. He plays Caligula. The lead in it is Derek Jacobi playing Claudius. But it's got Patrick Stewart in it playing Sejanus, who tries to marry into the royal family in Rome. It takes place in Rome. You know, it's about the pre-Nero fall.
Great miniseries. I mean,
it is unbelievable. It's got Brian Blessed and Sean Phillips in it. Blessed was in Flash Gordon. Sean Phillips was in Dune. And it is so magnificent. I can't recommend this highly enough to everybody listening. You've got to go if you've never seen I, Claudius. Which was directed by Herbert Wise and written by...
Okay, we lost Dean. Are you there, Jerry?
I'm here.
Okay, we lost Dean. We'll never know who directed I, Claudius. Herbert Wise. All right. Sorry, Dean. You got dropped. It wasn't me, I promise. Let's get to our last interview. Let me say, follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite. YouTube, youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited. And for all the updates on the show, go to our website, moviegeeksunited.net. We're coming back Wednesday night with...
our 80s list.
Yeah, our personal favorite films of the 1980s. That's going to be fun.
Yes, it will, definitely.
So get out the headband and the leg warmers and tune into our show on Wednesday night, Best of the 80s. All right, dude, thank you so much, man. I enjoyed tonight's show.
No, definitely. A pleasure, always. And we'll be back Wednesday.
Okay, we're going to close off the show with a trilogy of interviews. With the makers and a co-star of a new movie called For the Love of Money. This movie spans two decades, and it tells the story of an Israeli immigrant who comes to America, and in his search for the American dream, he falls into a criminal underworld. And it's actually really distinguished by the cast. I mean, the cast is amazing. You have James Caan, Jeffrey Tambor, Stephen Bauer, Paul Sorvino. You've got all these great colorful characters. And one of the great characters in the piece, he kind of steals the show, is played by Richard Gunn. And he's the actor that we're going to speak to in this interview, alongside the director, Ellie Kanner, and the screenwriter, Jenna Madison. So enjoy it, guys, and we'll see you back here on Wednesday.
We got a line on this diamond broker. The owner's holding $500,000 in diamonds and cash in a safe in his office.
Yes, like we're Robin Hood. Steal from the rich, give to ourselves.
What do you say, man?
I love to drive. Kind of like life in Fast Four.
We got you beat.
What can I do for you, gentlemen?
Yeah, we'd like a whole shipment of diamonds.
Open it. Try and steal from me.
Your information's wrong.
Don't lie to me. I'm coming down, and I'm taking your eyes out of your head, and I'm going to send him to your whore of a mother.
You want to see your cousin alive? You return my $2.8 million that Levi stole from you.
When is he coming? I have to go.
You have to go. You're choosing to go.
I mean, there is no choice here.
Give me a sense of Jenna, where this came from. It's based on a true story of one of your producers on the film,
yes,
isn't
it? It is. It's based on his true story, but you know, you can't just. We had to be pretty close to the truth, and frankly, as a screenwriter, that ties your hands a lot because you want to be able to, you know, put in things for quote-unquote dramatic effect, and I got to play a little bit, you know, like I'm sure you probably remember the moment where Vince's character sings the Iran song or, you know, some of the things that I got to have fun with. But yes, it was based on a true story, and I have to say that's probably, oddly enough, you'd think it would be the easiest thing for a writer to just pick up a story that's already there and just write it. But frankly, it's harder than creating something on a blank page from your mind, just spilling out. And, you know, when I write, I always say it's like taking dictation. I don't know where it comes from, but it comes from some other realm and my fingers just move. And with this, it was very systematic and very specific what I could do, what I could create, and what I could make the characters do. So in certain ways, it's really cool because you get to learn a different form of the craft. But in other ways, I just go, oh, man, wouldn't it be cool if the character could do this? You know? So,
well, I would think it would have to be this delicate balance between paying honor to his experience in his
exactly.
life and giving voice to your own kind of expression at the same time.
Exactly. And, yeah. And you know, there were, like I said, there were some moments that I got to create. There were some things. One of my favorite sequences in the whole film is that jewelry heist sequence from the time they meet at the bar to the time, you know, where it ends and you know, Yuta slams the door and leaves the car. To me, was something that we needed so much in the film that, yes, anyone who makes a story about their life, it's like you always want to look really good, right? You don't want anyone to think you're a jerk. But at the end of the day, if you don't include the moments that you had to make a choice or had to, you know, do something that maybe isn't going to be so popular, if you don't include those, then you just have a homogenized version of your life. And, you know, hats off to Isaac for allowing me to write that part into the film and, you know, taking the risk that he did in doing that.
So, Ellie, how did you come on board the project?
Well, I came on board through Jenna. I knew Jenna through my sister-in-law, who is the casting director, who was hired on the project, one of the casting directors. And Jenna saw me at a party, and I think she was being nice and said, hey, I've got this project. You know, we have a few directors, a few male directors that, you know, it's an Israeli action drama, and I don't know if it's, you know, something you'd be interested in doing, but, you know, take a read and see what you think. And so with that, I sat down and I read it, and what really drew me to it was there were two things. It was the message about the importance of friends and family, and it was also about the fight and the struggle to make good choices in life. And those two struck me as something that it's just a message that I believe in, I wanted to be a part of. I came in and I met and I sat down with Jenna and with Isaac and we were on the same page about everything. You know, the original version, just the characters, you know, they sort of, you know, jumped off the page in terms of you know, you think, really, this happened? Really? And some of the things that happened were crazy. And like Jenna said, some we could take a little bit of dramatic license, but, you know, it was all there. And together, you know, working on it from day one until, you know, editing and through everything, I just felt like it was something that we wanted to share with people. And when I said it was the most fun I had on the project, sitting in that audience, you know, seeing people that really felt good at the end. There are so many movies you watch these days, and at the end you feel sort of depleted, you know, you feel depressed or angry. And this is a movie that I was really proud to be a part of, because people at the end, you know, felt inspired, and that was just wonderful. And I thank Jenna for, you know, allowing me to be a part of it.
Well, and I think a lot of the qualities that you just spoke of really set it apart from other movies in this
genre.
Kind of genre that you'd put it in. Because, I mean, this is a very genre that's been explored quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the humanity of the characters and the kind of the focus you make on the choices that they make really, really set it out. I mean, Jenna, when you heard, was it Isaac? Was it his story?
It was Isaac's story, yes.
When you heard his story, what about his journey set it apart for you from all the other similar kind of genre films?
I really liked the concept and the idea of seeing it from the perspective of the good guy. We always see these gangster movies that glorify the violence and the criminal element and all of that. And I felt like we were seeing something completely original in that you get to see it from the perspective of someone on the receiving end, not these thugs. And, you know, I know that can and will inspire criticism, like, oh, we should have had more violence, or we should have had more this. We made those choices very specifically.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want the movie to be gory. We didn't want it to be gratuitously violent, and we wanted it to feel like it was, we didn't want to make the bad guys and the criminals seem like they were glamorized. And I think we did that. I think you walk away thinking like, hey, you know what? I'd rather be like that when I, you know, like if a kid watches that movie, they'll say, oh, I want to be the good guy. I want to end up with a great family, and I want to end up with a good life. I don't want to be the thug criminal that, you know, ends up dead. And I think with a lot of gangster movies, look, I love them. I mean, there are amazing movies out there. But I feel like never before has someone taken the stance of, hey, what about the good guys? What about when the good guys win? Like, can we, you know, can we show that? And so that was part of the story. I guess my favorite part of it was that we could show something with a moral, with a message, and still have the fun and the excitement and the danger, you know, of a gangster movie.
Well, and there's, you know, we've seen stories of Italian immigrants, Cuban immigrants, but what specifically kind of defines the Israeli immigrant experience as it pertains to your story, do you think?
Well, can I be honest? Well, I should be honest, right? let me be painfully honest. I wanted more of the Israeli element. I
yes,
really wanted, and so did Ellie. I mean, we fought really for that. And we didn't quite get there. And so I wanted to bring, you know, more of the Jewish element, more of the Israeli element, because frankly, that's who these people are, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In the Italian mobster movies, they're always eating cannolis or going to church, or, you know what I mean? It's just part of the fabric of these people. But, you know, there was, I'll be really honest, there is still in the world anti-Semitism.
Mm.
And there was some concern about, you know, are people going to be upset if it's quote-unquote too Jewish? And it just goes to show you that in this day and age, you know, that still exists. People still have to fear that. And it's just so sad to me that we're still in that world where we can't just all, you know, accept each other. And so I would have personally liked to have seen so much more Israelisms in the film. But I think we did well in that. Josh Bitten is Israeli. Of course, Yehuda Levy is a big Israeli star. He's like the Tom Cruise of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And we really, you know, tried to make it as authentic as possible.
And Richard, your character, I mean, this is an incredibly juicy character. And I'm wondering what most excited you about the prospect of playing him?
Well, I got to say that just overall, the fact that he was a bad guy, because I don't get the opportunity often to play a criminal or bad guy. And secondly, he was fairly open to interpretation, I think,
mm-hmm.
because he wasn't one of the real people. He's actually a fictional element to the story. So we had a lot of creative license with him, and I think thirdly the leather pants. It's a big draw for me.
Another fan for
well,
the best.
You know, the physicality, the physicality of the character. I mean, you have this. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to remember you have this terrific kind of Fu Manchu-ish mustache
yes,
going on.
That is,
yeah,
that is correct.
Yeah, well, did that kind of? I mean, how much does the physical attributes of a character? How much does that inform the internal aspect of it?
Oh,
for
it's
you?
Huge. It's huge for me. Especially with this character. I mean, putting on the costume and, you know, living in that character hugely informed my take on it and my playing of it. The mustache, I mean, it sounds trivial, I guess, but it just those things make it so much more real.
Mm-hmm.
to me as the actor and make the character so much more accessible when I'm playing it.
And Richard, wasn't it you that came up with the comb, comb hairbrush? I mean, the comb a blade?
The switchblade comb.
The switchblade comb. I couldn't remember the name of it. Yeah.
No, that was Jenna, actually.
Oh, Jenna, okay. I mean,
yeah.
That was, you know, it's those tiny things that really sets a character apart. And, you know, when he takes out that switchblade comb and the audiences laugh and they, you know,
mm-hmm.
they get it. They just, it's something that's not only memorable, but it's, you know, it's perfect for the character. And
yeah.
Those are the tiny, juicy things that, you know, Jenna, and you know, comes up with or has come up with that just make the character more full.
But he did come up with the leather pants, remember?
Oh, the leather pants.
He came
pants,
with
right.
one day and he was like, had this little, like, cat ate the canary grin on his face. And he's like, what if the character wore leather pants? And Ellie and I looked at each other and we were like, yeah.
Well, and you say you really relish the opportunity to play the bad guy. But, I mean, I find that every villain kind of feels like the hero of his own story.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, of course. You can't approach a character with a judgment on him like, oh, he's a bad guy. I mean, I'm saying that objectively speaking,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the story, he's, you know, a bad guy. But, you know, everybody is completely justified in their actions in their own mind, and so I don't think Vince thought he was really much of a bad guy at all.
No, I think he was doing the right thing, you know. He was taking care of himself.
For himself,
unfortunately.
Yeah,
it didn't work
yeah.
out so well.
Well, Ellie, you started, I mean, you have a lot of experience in the realm of casting.
I do.
And what a cast you have here. I mean, oh, my gosh, like supporting players all around, just top shelf.
We were.
Mm-hmm. Please, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say we were just fortunate enough to, you know, we have great casting directors, Mary Jo and Dory, and Jenna and I, you know, sat in the casting sessions, and it was challenging because, you know, Isaac had, there were real people that people were going to be portraying, so we had pictures, and we had to try and, you know, try to make them look similar, yet the actors themselves had to have the quality that we were looking for in the characters. So it was a little bit challenging, but I think, you know, we got fortunate and we ended up making some good choices, and we're very happy with them.
Well, You're working with a lot of veteran actors in the film. I mean, you look at James Caan and Jeffrey Tambor and Stephen Bauer, Sorvino.
Right.
Do you find that actors are for the most part pretty similar in what they need from a director, or do you cater to different kind of needs for each?
Oh, you have to cater to different their different needs, because everyone's, you know, all actors are unique and have their own way of getting where they need to be. Some actors want to be, you know, told certain things before they discover them on their own, and then they sort of can tweak them and make them feel, you know, like they're their own. And then others, you know, others don't. So it just depends. I mean, with James Caan, you know, he was more about he came in with some ideas of how he wanted to play it, and you know, we discussed a lot of things.
Oh, Ellie, you're so polite.
Well, we did. He had some ideas, and Jenna and
I
to persuade him away from certain ideas that he wanted to do, because, you know, there's also, you talk about how actors want, you know, they're even if they're playing villains, you know, they believe what they're doing, but some people can go too far, and you have an actor that wants this character to still be nice and do things that, you know, you don't know if the character would actually do, because, you know, the actor wants the guy to be likable. When, in fact, you
really
know... Yeah, go ahead, Richard.
I'm sorry, it doesn't serve the story.
Exactly.
Right.
So, So with Jimmy Caan, you know, he wanted... Go ahead.
I'm sorry,
no,
I was just going to chime in about working with the veteran actors and that experience.
Go ahead.
It just, you know, there's it's interesting because some of them, and I'm just being really candid here, and why not, right? It's Saturday morning, and let's go for it. some of them were awesome. I mean, just gentlemen from start to finish. Menches just came in. We're all about the work and all about just supporting everyone. And there was, you know, one that was the bad apple. And you really got to see how in this industry, you know, there is so much put on an actor in terms of importance.
Mm-hmm.
And some people buy into it. You know, some people believe their own publicity and some people don't. And they still manage to be human and still manage to be good people. And we were really lucky in that most of our actors were just really good human beings that just supported us, supported the film, you know, never once looked at Ellie and I and said, hey, how do a couple of chicks know about making a gangster movie? What are you talking about? You know, like they never challenged us in that way because they believed in what we were doing. And were incredibly supportive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the best actors are the ones that don't view it as kind of a solitary exercise. I mean, it's all about the kind of collaborative spirit.
Mm-hmm. For sure, yeah. And some of them just don't have that ability. You know, they're just not used to it, and they choose not to take it that way. And you know, so what you do in that situation is you get through it and you get what you need and it somehow usually turns out okay.
Yeah.
And somehow in editing you create magic. And you know, it's really truly, I mean, I think editing is the most, in my opinion, the most important element of filmmaking.
Well, make the film three times. You know, you have the script that's being written. That's one version. And then you have the one that you actually shoot and the footage that you get. And then you definitely rebuild and reshape it in editing. And it could make or break a film.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I talked to a very, you know, I can't even remember his name, but it's the editor of I Heart Huckabees. And he said something to me. He said, Jenna, you know, editing is like sleight of hand. It's kind of like trickery, like magic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to let the audience in on too much. And I remembered that throughout the whole editing process because I feel like in a lot of ways, you know, we did do sleight of hand. We did, you know, in the way that the movie, I think, keeps your attention from the word go to to the finish at a, you know, breakneck pace sometimes, that's, we wanted to do that. We wanted it to feel like you go in and it's, and it's,
you're on a ride and you keep going.
You're on
until
a
the
ride,
end.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and there's, in terms of the actual production of it, I mean, there's one other collaborator that I wanted to ask you about, and that's your DP, who's such a great, I mean, such a great body of work that he's built up. What was the conversation between the two of you about creating the look of this film?
Well, we wanted, and Jenna was involved in this as well. I mean, we wanted to have a style to it. You know, there's so many, like you said, there's so many different gangster movies, and obviously we're inspired by them, but we really wanted to, you know, keep the pace and the rhythm, you know, fast, and keep people, you know, hold, like grab the audience and hold them throughout. And so we wanted these scenes to move. We wanted to have quick transitions. We wanted to, you know, but also at the same time, let it breathe in certain moments to have the dramatic effect. So it was, you know, the style we created for like the gangster effect that we called, where every time we introduced a different gangster, we, you know, we just did a little something. It's so hard to do something fresh because everything has been done.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we tried to sort of add our style to it, and you know, I think we succeeded without it being without copying you know, another film, but being inspired.
Every time I watch that gangster intro for Eddie Furlong, I still go, that's so cool. Like, every single time. It never gets old for me.
Yeah. So what's the – I know it opened in New York and L.A. Yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
What are the plans from here for our listeners out there that perhaps don't live in those two cities?
Well, I mean, hopefully if we're a great, big, fat, you know, success, we'll move on and go on to more cities. We are opening in Israel June the 25th. It did come out on Blu-ray in Australia on the 6th, and it comes out on VOD and DVD through Lionsgate. They say the third quarter, which is really like August, September of this year, and that's the plan.
I'd be interested to know if the Israeli audiences, if their reaction to the film would be at all different from the American audiences.
Well, I will let you know, because I'm going to Israel. So I know I'm very interested to see that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they'll embrace it. I don't know how many Israeli American movies, you know, have come out. Mm-hmm. And I think it's different. I think it's something that hasn't been shown there, and I think they'll like it. I think they'll respond to it.
Yeah.
I hope so.
I want to know what's coming up for you guys. Richard, you're working with Michael Biehn right now, aren't you?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm working on a film with him called Treachery, and also Jennifer Blanc is in the film, who I worked with on Dark Angel.
Mm.
Wow, that.
I like Michael a lot. He's a great guy. So is that a
yeah?
He's somebody else is directing it though, because I know he just had his directorial debut. But what is your role in this film?
I play a guy named Robert who is engaged to marry Jennifer Blanc's character, and I'm like the antithesis of Michael Biehn's character. He plays a guy who's a real shark businessman and doesn't have necessarily a great moral compass. And my character is more of the opposite, where I'm like an activist and idealist and really, really good guy. So it's a real opposite of my character and For the Love of Money.
Yeah. And Jenna, how about you? You're writing, if I read this correctly, you're writing a pilot at the moment, or?
No, I wrote a TV movie that actually Ellie and I are working on together that she's going to direct, and called Committed. And I also wrote a novel called Messiah. That's based on, you know, real, it's like historical religious thriller. Mm. And
I
just finished writing the script, and it's, you know, looking like it will be made into a film, and it's a trilogy of books, and I'm very, very proud of it.
Well, I know that you have a history as an actor as well. What does writing give you that creatively that acting does not, and vice versa?
Everything. I love being a writer. I can't tell you. It's almost like I feel guilty getting paid for it because it's the most fun I have in the day. I really escape into it. There's a lot of times if anyone watches me write, I usually have a smile on my face.
Mm-hmm.
As an actor, I loved acting. It was fun. It was breezy. It was, you know, it was what it was. But it didn't have to me, I didn't connect to it in the same way as I do as a writer. These characters are real to me. They have a life. Like, they don't just die on the page. They live.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds like I'm waxing poetic about writing, but frankly, it's just so, every character means something to me. Like writing the character of Vince was such a blast for me because it's taking someone and just, you know, one of the things that we had, what was kind of like an inside joke between us was he wore Duran Duran t-shirts under that black jacket. Nobody really knew that, but the backstory of this character was that he wanted to be a drummer in the 80s, and he failed. You know, like he wanted to be like in a hair band.
Wow.
And so it's like creating these nuances of these characters. Like I don't know if you noticed, but Oded Fehr's character, he speaks in a very used car salesman sort of lingo. Even though he's Israeli, he's buddy and pal and, you know, let's make the deal and I've got opportunities. And he's a salesman. He's a swindler. And so it's just getting to put those nuances on a character and creating a whole person is like the most exciting thing that I can possibly think of. So do I miss acting? Absolutely not. it was, a choice that I made. When I really just realized that I'm a writer and a producer, that's who I am, and acting was fun, but that part is behind me.
Yeah, well, Ellie, I mean, you got to really flex some new kind of muscles in this film because it's so different from your other works.
Mm-hmm.
What future projects are coming up for you, and what excites you about those?
Well, my next film, it's nothing like this, although I had a blast on this film with all the action. But my next movie is a comedy, and it's an indie film that I'm hopefully going to be shooting in August, and it's about six novelists who form a writing group, and most of them are just horribly untalented. And the least likely become successful, and then the others are jealous and resentful and envious, and then they have to create their own successes in kind of, you know, different and unusual ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of early Woody Allen cross between Christopher Guest with a little Get Shorty pace to it.
Well, that's an unbeatable combination there. I like
that.
Yeah,
so that's my next project. And I'm also, you know, I'm excited about the movie of the week with Jenna, of course, Committed. And then, we'll see what other projects come up. So I'd love to do some more action films or some action, you know, TV episodic shows, which are some of the shows on TV are just simply amazing. I'm sure that will hopefully keep me busy.
Well, let me tell you, you guys made a terrific film. And all three of you guys, your contribution to the film is just incredible. And so I congratulate you, and I wish you the very best of luck with the run of the film in theaters. And thank you all so much for joining me today.
Our pleasure. Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie.